Blog Talk Radio.
This is Jennifer Lindsay. I'm calling in to host the A-List today. We interview featured folks that are influential in their various industries. So I want to welcome you to the A-List. Again, I'm Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, March 26, 2010, I will be joined by Nick Douglas, who's a writer and comedian. You may know Nick from the different places he writes. He writes about technology and culture at a few different places. Burlesque is one of them, so it's URLESQE, Lala Wag, and on his own blog, Too Much Nick. Nick, are you there?
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the A-List. How are you?
Thank you. Good.
So how are you? Where are you on this fine Friday?
I'm in Williamsburg, last week before I move into Manhattan, actually.
Ah, I see. So you're going up to the big city. So
moving up.
Tell us what you've been up to lately. What have you been writing about that has really gotten you excited?
Well, lately I've been working, as you said, for Burlesque. It's a blog in one of AOL's newer blog networks. Where we've got, you know, a men's blog, several other topical blogs, and Burlesque is just basically about funny stuff happening on the internet. It's a really fun place to be. After working there for a little bit, I've realized that it's what I tried to turn all my other jobs into. I was a Gawker for a while, and, you know, I would just see something funny online or some cute video or some neat art project and just want to stick it on Gawker. It wouldn't necessarily be good media commentary or anything, and I always try to squeeze it into their topic area. And now at Burlesque, I just get to do that with no pretense of media commentary or anything. Although we do get to analyze a lot of this stuff, which is really fun.
So talk about the analyzing. That's kind of interesting. So you're looking at, I guess, reactions, right, to what you're writing?
Yeah, and a little bit of it is sort of, some of it is sort of commentary on say, what it means. Like, I got to write this piece a few weeks ago about Pedo Bear, this, character on 4chan that, like, he's a bear who runs after little girls. And so he's sort of used as this mocking of perverts online. And because he's used on this forum 4chan, a lot of news organizations kind of misinterpret it as some endorsement of terrible activity when 4chan has actually several times gone out of their way to hunt down and arrest internet pedophiles or any other criminals. You can't even put a video some kids have even put videos of abusing animals, and 4chan still is like, you know, we're going after these guys. And 4chan has actually done some great vigilante justice. But anyway, all I get to cover in there is just how these weird characters come about and how they mean different things to different people. Because characters like Pedo Bear or this character Bachelor Frog, who one other of our writers wrote about recently, they all have different meanings to whoever makes them and makes some content using them. You know how Bugs Bunny, there's someone in charge of what Bugs Bunny means and what Bugs Bunny is like. Clearly, you know, there are channels people have to go through at Warner Brothers if they want to add something to the canon of Bugs Bunny. Whereas any of these characters, Bachelor Frog, Bachelor Frog is just something where someone takes a frog face, puts it in front of this little green background, and says some instructions. And it's basically things that people do when they're living alone and really sloppy, like, you know, wake up, look at the clock, it says 1:30. Look out the window to see whether it's a.m. or p.m. Or, you know, leave laundry in a clothes dryer, use it as a dresser. Just simple, like, things like that. But people can add anything they want, and so the character evolves, and no one's actually in charge of who Bachelor Frog is. And so that's the fun stuff that we get to write about.
Yeah, it's sort of almost a crowdsourced way of controlling imagery, but it sadly, if this speaks to what I read, it kind of reminds me of the Da Vinci Code when I read it, and you know, Robert Langdon's character, you know, looking at symbols over time, you know, what was the Nazi symbol before the Nazis adopted it or before it was turned around and that sort of thing. And I think that's a really interesting way to sort of talk about how you write about the intersection of technology and culture. Do you feel like that's a good representation of an example that, you know, you could probably write about that until Kingdom Come, right?
Yeah, I absolutely love explaining and exploring what these different things mean and how, yeah, they shift, they change in a much more fun, interesting way to me than even the way that companies can change. Like, obviously, again, with the Looney Tunes characters, they've changed over time, but that was so controlled, and the characters were so fun back in the beginning, but then eventually, you know, they just get used more and more as merchandising. I was reading recently, someone was saying, the Tasmanian Devil. When's the last time anyone actually watched a cartoon with Taz in it? And yet you see him on so many little bits of merchandise, these characters get more and more boring. On the internet, a character, you know, gets more interesting as it keeps evolving. And if it does eventually get tired, we move on, we get a new character, and we can have all sorts of crossover between pretty much every meme on the internet. Every time there's a new meme coming out, I wait to see it get mashed up with others. Recently,
yeah.
There's a cat. Have you seen the video of a little cat that has its mouth wide open, and now it's called OMG Cat?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would recommend anyone listening Google it, and there's a little YouTube video of OMG Cat, and he's just this cute little panting cat. There's some argument that I've read over whether he burned the roof of his mouth or if he's just tired out or... But anyway, he's this little panting cat with his mouth wide open, and of course he looks really surprised, even turns his head at some point. And so I was able to stick him into a few viral videos as if he's reacting to the different things he's watching, like a ninja cat. It's very simple, and it was no grand thing, but each of these little mashups slowly evolves what OMG Cat means. There was Keyboard Cat, that at first was just a cat playing the keyboard. That was all it was. And then when someone thought, oh, the idea of Keyboard Cat is he plays people off, that you insert him halfway through a video before everything's fallen apart, he's just standing there waiting. And then when someone really messes up, Keyboard Cat plays them off. And that evolved. There became rules, ways you do it properly, ways you don't. And I really like that. People can write these angry rules about how other people are doing it wrong, about something that no one technically has the authority to give the rules, and yet it does seem right when someone says, this is the good way to do this. people are just explaining to each other how to tell stories, how to tell jokes. And I think that's fantastic and really fun to examine.
Yeah, and it reminds me too, I think there's so many of us that have been on the internet for so long, we're always looking for ways to take visuals that are iconic and see how they might have changed over time. I know that I had a really interesting conversation once with Augie Ray, the guy that took Jeremiah Ouyang's place at Forrester. But one of his interests is Disney, and I used to work for ABC for quite a while, so I know the Disney canon, and I know the power of their lawyers to make sure that that brand, the brand stays true, and Mickey is never used in an inappropriate way. And so it's interesting because, I mean, one of Augie's pastimes has been kind of collecting the ways that Mickey has changed over the years and, you know, the different iconic changes. And, you know, some of the people are really well known for changing Mickey, and then there are other redos that, you know, weren't so popular, or the introduction of Minnie and when that happened, and, you know, what does it mean for a mouse to be in a relationship, you know, and that then, you know, people like me, their mind goes into really dirty places, and that's not
right,
good.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it seems like the natural evolution of, you know, kind of where our mind goes anyway. And it's interesting to me, too, because it seems like, you know, from all the research that we know, you know, in terms of target audiences, Generation Y is really, they're fine with authority. You know, they're much more about, like, organizational structures than Generation X, for example, who are probably the two biggest users online and, you know, I would assume reading your materials, right? So, you know, you might get an interesting intersection of different age groups reading the material and having very different points of view on what it means to make the changes. So then the rules, the kind of, you know, crowdsourced society rules kind of change because of that.
I would wonder also if Generation Y has, which I consider myself a part of at age 25, we accept that there is authority and yet somehow feel more natural routing around it. I feel like to someone a few years older than me, pirating music is still this thing you do if you really want to stick it to the man. When I see Cory Doctorow and even the EFF talk about pirating, it's like, we're doing this because you're going down and blah, blah, blah. Well, someone my age or younger takes music and is like, no, I'm kind of stealing, but it's easier this way and it just works, and I hope everyone works a way to make this okay, but this is what I'm going to do. Like, it's so much less about sticking it to anyone and more about, like, this is very convenient, which means mm-hmm. that indie artists, I think, have to be very careful to realize your fans aren't necessarily going to go pay for your music just because you're indie and they know that the music's going, or the money is all going to you. You actually need to openly approach these fans. You need to engage them. You need to do what OK Go does and say, we're doing more than giving you music. OK Go is understanding that they can't rely, you know, that they left their label recently over, mm-hmm. Presumably over all the disagreements they'd been publicly talking about, how they just, you know, see, they clearly see their music as part of a whole presentation that they're giving, and that they need to explore how they can make a living off of all of that, because it's harder and harder to make a living off of simply the recorded music. That's why one of the reasons that they have a really good, or it just works for them, because they have a really good concert presence. They're just great performers. And
Yeah. That's
the sort of change that I think is very aware of how Generation Y views this stuff so differently.
So how much do you feel like, since you've kind of been at different roles where you've tried to make the role fit you, now that you have more latitude, tell me about the things that you can do that makes this, make where you're writing now really about your, you know, the things that you love or are passionate about.
Well, like I say, with OMG Cat, here I'm finally getting paid to take a YouTube video, splice it together in iMovie HD, and throw it back up on YouTube. This is the sort of thing lots of other people are doing for free, which is a good thing. Most of them should be. But, yeah, I'm getting to actually be part of the process. One of the big things at Erlesk is that they're very into... because obviously they're entering this field. Erlesk has been around for about 2 years now, and you know we're in a field that's also covered by Boing Boing, Meterama, BuzzFeed, a lot of great sites, Know Your Meme, all of them covering different aspects of this, and that's one thing I really like. There are lots of people who read several of these sites. It's not like you get your one funny internet site. And that's all you need. You actually, there's enough going on, like music blogs, that people don't have to watch or listen to everything on one music blog. They can actually read several. That's really exciting to me. But anyway, what Erlesk is definitely wanting to do is be part of that, make new things, discover stuff that no one has seen before. Before I joined, we were able to find the kid who was setting up a video blog in an Apple store. So he would always just update from the Apple Store, and we helped him get a little bit of popularity. He was on a few of the talk shows, and that was really fun. We got to be a part of that discovery, and not just tell people what the internet is already talking about, but to be some of the first. We found this video that hasn't gotten many views to I think today. Yeah, we just posted at one this kid who stayed after school until the school was totally empty, and started making sounds, hitting the lockers, playing a piano in the band shell, and he put it all together into one of those great, beatbox-style videos, highly edited videos, using his whole school. It looks beautiful, and he even puts in a sample of when one of the teachers or administrators shows up and says good morning to him. That sample is thrown in there, and hopefully, we'll get to be one of the first sites showing this to everyone, and hopefully, it'll get all the attention that it deserves because it's a really fantastic piece. So that's my favorite part is being part of the process instead of just reporting on it.
So this is all really unique content that you're putting together and, kind of leading the charge for something new. And, as you mentioned, you've had some other jobs along the way. You want to talk a little bit about your career path and how you've gotten to a place where you're actually enjoying and getting paid for what you do? Because I think that's something so many people aspire to, and they forget sometimes along the way what they wanted to do back then.
Mm-hmm. And I've been very lucky that the many jobs that I've turned down, actually, which is the main theme of my career, I think, has been turning down very good, solid jobs because I was too sure that I could do something on my own, screwing that up entirely, and then waiting around until someone rescued me. Gawker Media hired me out of college to do a blog called Valleywag. This was in 2006, or late 2005 they found me, because I had been writing a blog called Blogebrity. I was doing that. Blogebrity was started by Kyle Bunch, and that was part of a project run by Huffington Post called Contagious Media, where people were competing to see how many people they could get attracted to some new project that they invented. The site Black People Love Us was part of that. That was one of the most famous results of this contest.
Mm-hmm.
But Blogebrity was just a gossip blog about bloggers, and it was run with the pretense that we'd turn it into a magazine. And for a little while, for a few weeks, we were thinking maybe we should print a magazine about bloggers, which I think would have been really fun. But I was writing for them because Kyle wasn't able to update the post every day because he had a real job. I was doing data entry at a travel agency, and
oh my.
Wanted to waste, a lot of my time. And so got noticed, got sent to Valleywag, had a really fun time there covering, Silicon Valley, and it's different characters. But I most of the mistakes I feel I made there were because I am in no way a good journalist. I love mixing stuff up and I love doing commentary, but whenever we need to really research a story on Arlesque, I hand it to one of our good actual journalists who go and interview and get stories right, because I have found I am always so intent on putting a narrative on something that's a very dangerous thing when your job is to actually find out facts. And I think to some extent almost everybody in blogging journalism does this, because there's so little oversight that someone decides that this is the story and then they just run with that story and no one tells them otherwise because they just get the reader to agree with them. So I felt I would get sick of any of these different jobs that was about journalism and treating things somewhat seriously, which I know Gawker is never, they're not exactly looking for Columbia Journalism School grads all the time, although they now have more and more actual journalists on staff. But
they had a good post that got some traction on one of our listservs recently.
Mm-hmm.
As a side note, there was somebody at ValleyWag posted a question that someone had from the New Media alumni list, which I'm a part of, at Columbia. There had been more answers in the chain, but the headline was something akin to, apparently one of the most prestigious journalism schools doesn't know how to use a cell phone or something like that. And people on the list just went nuts. And I actually thought it was the funniest thing ever, because I actually, even though I went to Columbia and have been a journalist with a capital J, sit in a place where, I know all of that is basically, if it hasn't been blown up and started over, it needs to be. And this radio show is part of that, right? I didn't really feel like there was a place for this anyplace else. So I went and created it. And so I get to talk to people like you and a great mix of interesting people. But in any event, I can definitely relate to that kind of journey where, you get these inside scoops and you want to be able just to sort of, Gawker's very tongue-in-cheek, but it's still very fact-based.
Yeah.
So you tell narrative.
Sorry?
So I just was pointing out, to the audience, so you know where I was going with it. In contrast, you like to really, have narrative.
Yeah.
And
I really like, I really like adding a spin, adding an angle, coming up with a clever thing. And I've found more and more, I guess I'm haughty to say I've kind of an understanding what Jon Stewart, hero of all fake journalists, says, that he knows that he provides a very, very valuable service to people trying to understand the news. He clearly knows that part of his job is to go find hypocrisy and point it out. That's good. I don't know if that's what journalism. I feel like that's good journalism, right? That's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to show you what's actually going on, add some context.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, anytime someone calls him out for doing the same things that he tells Fox News and other people not to do, he knows he can hide behind, I'm on Comedy Central. The show that leads into me is puppets making crank calls. And he's right. He knows also that at the end of the day, his job is to make a joke, and that the viewer is supposed to be savvy enough to know when he's cheating. And I really like that. I mean, I think it's maybe a bit of laziness on my part, but I like that. The one person I know who I always feel it was able to do journalism in that way that I never could is Alex Perrin on Gawker. Almost always I read something and I think, oh my God, you're brilliant and fair. He's so willing to say something that he's so willing to go against the party line or the obvious remark. and
mm-hmm.
he does it so well, and he's built such a trust in his readers that even the Gawker commenters, who can be so cruel when someone doesn't go with the party line, they'll respect him, they'll listen to him, because he has such a good way of explaining things. But meanwhile, I just love throwing in jokes, adding in whatever I can, putting in a narrative that's more fun and creative than necessarily here are the facts. If I get to actually throw some light on something, that's good. And at Erlesque, of course, a lot of our stuff is really, a lot of our daily posts are really just, here is this thing. There's not really, a slate-like unconventional wisdom that needs to be presented at Erlesque. A lot of it really just is getting interesting things in front of a wider readership. So there's not really much of a, cloak and dagger turnaround of narratives necessary there. But there's so much more chance for all this entertaining stuff. That's where I've always found the most fun is, between the Gawker work, where I did Valleywag and then later a little stint at Gawker.com, and a few other projects for their sites, worked for BuzzFeed for a month, got to play around, was at Huffington Post for a couple of months. All that was useful, but none of it stuck. I actually would have liked to go with BuzzFeed longer, but they ended up moving to this format where they don't really have full-time writers in the way that I'd be used to. But anyway, between all that, I did Twitter Wit, which was another fun project. That was the book that was a collection of witty Twitter messages from a few thousand different Twitter users. Many of whom I'd been following specifically because they always write funny messages, and several of whom, other hundreds of contributors to the book were, hundreds of applicants, I should say. We ended up with a few hundred, actual contributors to the book, but this was after sifting through over 10,000 different tweets. But a lot of them were the single funny thing someone had ever said on their Twitter feed they submitted. I would go and look because I loved following. If I found someone I hadn't discovered who has written, hundreds of witty messages, I would always love that and jump at the chance. But I'd often go and find out, oh, this person submitted the one funny thing they've ever written, and the rest of the time it's just a normal Twitter account, which I think is really great that, as much as I love all the people, and I'm going to always follow the people who only say funny things on Twitter, I really like that normal people, the people who don't use it as a place to hold comedy night for strangers, still appreciate putting something a little special into what's commonly seen as the most mundane internet content possible.
Sort of like the idea of the ignites that go on around the country, right? So you could have just a speaking event with a bunch of interesting people, but instead it's 20 slides, 15 seconds per slide, go. And, turns the whole idea of having, interesting topics at a venue kind of turns it on its head a little bit, or at least sideways.
I'm in love with the short form content with restrictions as a great way to force people to only give the good bits.
Yeah, that is a very, very good point because people can go on and on. One question I had for you is, while you were at your stint, since I'm sitting in a parking lot in Redwood Shores, I have to ask you, and you've, covered basically blogger news, kind of who your favorite characters were when you were trying to put the hat on of journalist with a capital J, or maybe put it off to the side or wear it in your back pocket when you were at Valleywag. If there are any interesting characters there or at any other places that you wrote that you found really interesting for any particular reason, like just sort of in the way that you sifted through Twitter Wit and people follow you because you have this ability to sift and find interest. I'm just curious in terms of the actual people you've come across or covered or interacted with, who's kind of stuck out?
Well, during ValleyWag, my favorite narrative was always the Yahoo versus Google narrative, and I feel sad that I never got more direct access to anything about Terry Semel, because he was fascinating to me. The CEO during 2006 of Yahoo.
The Hollywood guy turned, CEO of Yahoo. I mean, it seems like there would be an amazing story there. But, yeah, we got tidbits.
And the great thing was that the story wasn't Mr. Flashy Hollywood comes to Yahoo, but more Mr. Sad. Anytime you saw a photo of him, he looked like he was apologizing for something. He was just like a cute puppy dog face. And I loved this idea of the Hollywood guy who's like trying to get into the new hot internet world and just can't be glamorous enough in that tech way. What I liked about Yahoo was here's the company that theoretically should have been the glamorous company. Yahoo's the one that had such a media vibe to it. They were still a media company. And they had, they launched shows. Google would never launch a show. And yet Google was always the top dog, the sexier, slicker company. Even though it was made up of, nerdy engineers, they come off as the cooler, slicker people. And so I loved covering it as humans versus Cylons, because that's exactly when Battlestar Galactica was coming out. And it was the perfect, it fits so well. Marissa Mayer from Google, another of my favorite characters, because she, for me, she was this breaking out of a woman in tech who's not just being treated. We wouldn't just treat her as, oh, let's make the woman jokes. It was, let's make the robot jokes. It was just a little sign of we're gonna play real. We're gonna do some real jokes instead of stupid default, sort of things. As the sort of thing that you find on TechCrunch when Michael Arrington's trying to be funny, or something. That was our goal, was to reach beyond, because most of the tech humor is just really dull. And one of my favorite things was always explaining how, Marissa Mayer, okay, we believe everything you're going to tell the press. Because like anyone, when she's presented as this character to magazines, as this representative of Google, she acts like she leads this impossible life. She claims to have, something on the order of 16, 20 meetings a day, which means she's having just an entire day full of 15, 20-minute meetings, and meanwhile, do all these amazing things, gives this guide to her day that means that she must sleep about 4 hours a night, and whenever she's flying, she says, for business, she takes the red eye so she doesn't have to miss any work. Basically, she just sounds like a Cylon, like they don't need sleep, they don't need food. There's nothing flawed. They're not human. And that's why they're so much better and sleeker and sexier. And I love that. And meanwhile, she's this fun-sounding, interesting, brilliant person. But because she presented herself as this perfect thing, because you can't admit flaws when you're working at Google. It's not like Yahoo or almost a lot of other tech companies where you can admit we've messed up. Google is all about perfection and not messing up and being more than human. And so we would tease about that. That's why she became this great character to me.
Well, there was an interesting intersection between her and Michael Arrington. I don't know if you were at LaWeb this year, but he interviewed her for a keynote and started a conversation by saying he was going to try to butter her up and mentioned that she was on some top 10 list in a woman's magazine, I think it was Glamour, and she actually thanked him for that. And so for every woman in tech, I just felt like we were sort of deflated by being kind of you know, accepting the near flirtation of a Michael Arrington, right? It was it was sort of violating in a way, and I actually left the session then because I just felt like, I mean, it wasn't incredibly offensive to me, but it was just like, God, is everybody so dorky that we're going to, like, you know, use these really broad, you know, like, oh, you've been in Glamour. Wow, how great are you? Okay, now I'm going to ask you these really hard questions because I'm from TechCrunch and I used to be a lawyer. I mean, you know, it's sort of strange, and I mean, I think it's one of the interesting things about the whole blogger thing is that, you know, if you go to these conferences, especially outside the U.S., unless you're at TED, the personalities of the Arringtons and others tend to take over, and, you know, I mean, certainly Arrington as well as Robert Stoble, who I think actually is a far nicer person, you know, had actual roles in moderating panels, et cetera. And there's a British, I can't remember his name, but anyway, he is on staff at TechCrunch. And there was a wonderful European panel about why they're doing business in Europe as opposed to getting on a plane and coming to the U.S. And this person was just being contrarian to be contrarian. Well, I know that, you know, maybe Mike Arrington finds that funny and embraces it, but these poor guys didn't get to answer the question. And, you know, and I actually think there's a very valid point to it. So if you're coming up with a creative, interesting concept, if you're a technology anthropologist like Stefana Broadbent, don't you belong in the UK, maybe where TED is and around, you know, maybe more intellectual thinkers? Do you really belong in Silicon Valley? My answer is probably no. Because it's not that creative here, and people tend to not focus on the humor or the humanity of a lot of what we do. So I think that's one of the interesting things that you're touching on here is, you know, Twitter Wit. You said you went through what 10,000 posts. So how many were actually in the book? How many made it?
I always forget how many. Several hundred.
Approximately.
Several hundred. 600, 800. Yeah.
Pretty
and those 10,000 included ones that I picked up over 3 years after sifting through, you know, probably, I'd have to check, you know, my arithmetic, but possibly millions, I don't know, over 3 years.
That's a lot, kind of reasonable,
I guess. I honestly don't use Twitter as much anymore now that I'm on Tumblr and addicted to that. But I used to, you know, be keeping a steady stream reading it, and that's, you know, I think probably not a million, but maybe like half a million.
Wow, that's amazing.
Over 3 years of reading. I mean, plenty of people read that many, yeah. It's just, when you think about that.
How did you get the idea for Twitter Wit? Because I think it's such a great idea, and it was amazing that you got to it before anyone else, really.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised nothing had really come out before. Although it turns out that I got to the idea around the same time that David Polk got to it, and he ended up, of course, making The World According to Twitter, which was a different format because he was asking people for answers, and I was just asking people for permission for stuff they'd already written. So I thought that was interesting that we got actually two books that did different things out at the same time. Again, I really love when there's a sign that there's room for more than one player in something. But anyway, a couple of years back, you know, maybe a few months after Twitter had started, maybe a year or more, Rex Sorgatz and I had both...
Oh, my God! I used to work with him.
Yeah.
I know him from IDS. Tell him I said hello.
Oh, well. I will.
He's a great app developer. He's a character of his own. I got to say.
Yeah, completely.
To Rex, he had, when he was at IBS, so Internet Broadcasting Systems, I guess they go by IB now because of irritable bowel syndrome. and so anyway, he had, when I came to do training there on site, and I think, in Minnesota, right, they're located?
Mm-hmm.
I think he easily had the coolest office I'd ever seen in all of Minnesota. And that's not saying that I've seen a lot of offices there, but it definitely was on par with some top Valley executives. It was a freaking cool office. And he knew Flash kick ass. He's kick ass at Flash. So having said that, your friend,
yeah,
right?
Well, so he and I had independently, and our friend Matt Honan, who works for Wired and also invented Barack Obama's Your New Bicycle, which became a book of its own, too. But we had all thought, wow, someone should be collecting. And Rex is really good at this. Rex, this is one of my favorite things about him, and one of the things I identify with is he's always having a new idea for, well, always having 20 new ideas for a project that should be done, more than he could ever hope to ever enact. I would love to see if one day Rex were an investor or something, because then he'd finally possibly have the idea of helping out with nearly as many ideas as he comes up with. But we had all thought that, yeah, someone should be collecting this stuff and marking out the good ones. We were already noticing there are standout Twitter messages. And actually, what I counted as standout at that time, now I would count as mediocre, just because the vast number of people getting on there and the new things that they've done, not new in some mind-blowing way, but just the way that people have actually thought, I'm going to write a really good one-liner, I'm going to think about it for a long time, craft it, and put it on Twitter, is something that no one was doing yet. We were just seeing, incidental, accidental little brain farts that happened to be a little funnier than the rest. And so we played with the idea. Rex tried to pitch it to an agent. Didn't pan out. And then, a year later, I just went back to the project. I worked on it more. I got in touch with, my girlfriend now, who was not dating at the time, that she gave me her editor's email address, because my girlfriend Rachel Fershleiser was one of the co-editors of the Six Word Memoir books and for Smith Magazine. And so she gave me her editor's email address, and seeing the Six Word Memoir book was what made me click, made me think, oh, yeah, this is actually a good idea. I should actually go and do a full effort to make this a book. And because I saw it and saw, oh, this is more than a gimmick book. People are actually touched by this. And actually, the Six Word Memoir books have gone and inspired a lot more projects than Twitterwit has of yet. And it's been fantastic, because there, of course, people are summing up their entire life in six words, a lot of meaning to it. And so I tried to use that as my guide for Twitterwit. And I feel the book has actually come out very, very much in the tradition of the Six Word Memoirs.
So what do you, your name is one that everyone, that is someone, seems to know. What do you think you're most known for, in terms of jobs, or is it, you think it's your personality? What do you think it is?
I think so far it's both been a combination of Valleywag and Gawker in general, and my sort of young prodigal nature, and so actually during the last few months settling down, actually having just one girlfriend has been a little bit of a change. It's actually been really, there are so many times that I'm like, oh, that's what it means to regret things you did when you were younger. And finally, the first part of life where I get to realize how that feels, and mostly not regret, but just be like, well, gotta make sure people know, that I'm growing up, I'm doing different things. The number of people I run into who I wrote about at Valleywag is staggering to me.
Really?
At the time I was sitting, in my basement apartment. Actually, when I first started at Valleywag, I was in a 15-person former commune, and the first room I had in the house, I had different rooms as I throughout a year and a half, but I started in this one basement room. There's this, they had someone from the Chronicle in San Francisco was following me taking shots, and finally got his one semi-interesting shot, because when they have to take pictures of you looking at a laptop, it's always the worst in the world. But
yeah,
the basement room, But this basement room, the previous tenant had painted it some bright blue. I'm moving in on the first day. It's the same day that I have started working, and so there's no furniture. There's this tiny little ledge across the blue wall of the room, and I'm sitting on this little ledge. I'm basically leaning against a wall, typing on my little outdated Compaq from college, with nothing around me, big bare blue wall. And so I think that's the only reason that I got a nice big photo published. You know, I would have been in the back of a section if they hadn't gotten this great shot of the little blogger kid in his bare basement room. So given that little surrounding, it was so hard for me at that point to think about, well, partly just to think about consequences of anything I was doing, to think about the magnitude. Not that the blog was ever gigantic, it was just, you know, very much targeted at the right people such that people would talk about it a lot. That's one thing that Nick Denton has been great at, and now is, it seems like he's actively trying to move past that. Gawker, I think, has moved past it long since, but now, you know, it's no longer we've plunked one person down in this area and they're just going to run around with their underwear on their head, which was a fun era. But, like, you know, that's not how it is anymore. Gawker is a little too real and official, and it's good. It's just different, you know. So, yeah, feeling like I was running around with my underwear on my head, I didn't realize that I haven't even checked yet what I've written about Saul Hansel, who was at the Times, you know, the founding editor of the Bits blog. Well, now he's heading Seed at AOL. And so I had heard, I met him, and he's fantastic and really excited and has all these different ideas. But I had been told, like, oh, Saul Hansel heard that we'd hired you at Arlesque, and I don't know, he had a reaction or something. And I forget what someone was actually saying, but at the time I was scared because I've run into this before. I was scared that Saul was going to, like, see me in the AOL office and be like, what are you doing? 2006, you wrote this. And, you know, but no, he was perfectly fine. And you know, I'm sure the number of people who have written some stupid thing about him and his work over the years has been so large. But yeah, I've basically gotten to run into a lot of people who surprisingly seemed to like what I wrote in Valleywag, which is great. It's been really satisfying and made it easier having any other jobs in tech and in media when people already can put me in that context. Because, you know how, have you ever had the context where you meet someone, you're talking to them, and you know, they're giving you as much respect as they'd give anyone, but then maybe somehow you mention that you worked somewhere, did some project, and then suddenly they're like, oh, and suddenly they're listening to you more.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm a complete egomaniac, and I love that moment. There was a memoir or a collection of essays by the actor and playwright Wallace Shawn, who he published this sometime last year. Yeah, he's fantastic. And he writes about that moment, about how he finds that if someone doesn't know who he is, it takes every ounce of self-restraint to keep himself from telling them, because he so wants them to know who he is. And I love that he's able to admit this desire that I think almost everyone has, just some of us get to feed it more. And he says, I can never go.
Sure. I would think people would know Wallace Shawn by the moment he opens his mouth.
Right. The vast majority. I'm sure that, like, it probably takes a while for him to accidentally run into someone who clearly doesn't know who he is. And yet he says, in those cases, he cannot keep himself for more than a half hour. He's never gone more than a half hour without, you know, having to say something to casually drop in why he's important. And he rightly says, I think we all do this. We all love that. But anyway, I think there's a good side to it. That's nice to be reminded, you know, that you've done something that people like. It can be really good to know that when, at the time, all you knew was that you were sitting in your basement apartment.
Doing what they told you to do.
Exactly.
So one question I have that relates to the humor on Twitter is, obviously, it's exploded since the time you were probably initially collecting these funny tweets. That, you know, there's all these celebrities and especially people that are very humorous that are on Twitter, I feel really mixed about kind of the celebritization of Twitter. But there are definitely people in the middle that, you know, I think most people would agree kind of belong there, or it's cool that they're there. You know, it's fun to occasionally see them in your stream. But, you know, Brooke, whatever her name is, that's, you know, on Dancing with the Stars and had some sort of initiative. I know somebody that went and interviewed her down in L.A. because she was trying to do the mommy blogger thing, but on Twitter. And it's like, I don't think I need to. It has nothing to do with her being a woman or anything. It's like there's no substance. Like, what am I going to, you know, what am I going to learn? But someone like, you know, there's this guy that does this TV show called Screen Wipe.
Charlie Brooker.
Charlie Brooker, you know, is totally worth following. That guy's like priceless, right? So there, he's in the UK. Not a lot of people know who he is. My husband's English, and we watch a lot of British TV, so I know who he is, and I'm going to take advantage of it, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, what's your sort of take on this sort of celebritization of Twitter? I mean, you know, like, for example, this whole Ashton Kutcher thing makes my stomach crawl, but yet I like that Charlie's on, if that makes sense.
And partly, Ashton has to be on for people like Charlie to be on because, I don't know. Well, I mean, I guess that's not really true. But a lot of good celebrities that or other creative figures that I like and admire probably wouldn't have ended up on Twitter if it weren't for a lot of bigger celebrities making it known. And another thing is, okay, I don't like Ashton Kutcher particularly. I don't really go watch his stuff or anything. But when he uses Twitter, he uses it like anybody else would. He uses it pretty well. He doesn't just, like, use it to market his stuff. He actually is like, here are little things about my day. The fan club is all that really ends up annoying all of us, and the attention given to it, right? It is very silly for CNN to be competing with him for most followed and for everyone to be covering him and for bloggers to say, blah, 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 Ashton Kutcher, it means such and such. That's overanalysis, even if a little bit of it is deserved just because he's the most popular, which is he still the most followed person on Twitter?
I think it varies between him and a collection of other well-known
people. But I figure, on the one hand, it's sad to see the disappearance of that first age that almost any community online has. When Twitter started, it was just the nerds. You could feel this. You could recognize people if you just watched the public Twitter stream back when you could just watch every tweet that was going through. You would recognize people. If you, like us, were part of that crowd or paid attention to that stuff. And, of course, it's always going to suck when your favorite band gets huge and you can no longer go to the cool little downstairs bar concerts with them and you have to go to the stadium with everybody else. That's fair. But, on the other hand, this is inevitable and it's not like they've ruined the experience for those of us who don't have to follow, we're going to see the silly news reports and blog posts and everything, but Twitter isn't forcing us to look at these big users. Twitter isn't actually making us follow those people, and that's, I think, the important thing. You're still able to make your own little feed and your own collection and your own little world. So I think that it's fine. I think that Ashton Kutcher is a good user of Twitter who's you know, he's responsible. He doesn't use it to spam people. He's just so big that we all have to hear about it too much. And that's mainly just, you know, the media and new media's responsibility to stop themselves and say, am I writing this because it's interesting or useful or worthwhile, or because I think I'm going to get page views because it's about Ashton Kutcher? And I love all the other smaller creative celebrities who've gone on. Michael Ian Black was really funny, and also has set up his own site called Witstream, W-I-T-S Stream, and it's great. Every day I get a little email where he's picked three Twitter messages from usually professional comedians or actors or writers, and a couple of whom I get to recognize because they were early on in this group of people on Twitter who specifically made jokes, and that's been their own whole community in there. So there were all these amateurs, but some of them were, you know, practicing comedians. They're just using Twitter or something. And then separately, all these professional comedians who are better known have started using Twitter to actually try out their jokes. And I really like that. I like the idea that all these professionals are not seeing it as a waste of a joke, but seeing it as part of what they do. Is, you know, to go tell, and it's a great way to rediscover also why you're doing something if you're actually still willing to do it for free. That's a great way to remind yourself, wow, I really do like this. I'm not just doing a job because I'm caught up in the thing. If you're willing to go out there and do it for free on a website, then you probably really do like doing it. And that seems like a good affirmation.
So you aren't just writing for, am I saying it right, or less?
Yeah.
So you have your own blog, and are you writing anywhere else?
Yeah.
Too much blog.
Right, and like you said at LalaWag, I am occasionally contributing. It's harder for me to contribute as much now because I'm doing more at Earlesque. I joined Earlesque a few months ago as just a blogger, then I was a copy editor, and now I'm a senior editor, which means I'm day-to-day and also get to write posts and mostly features, which is really satisfying. But yeah, every now and then I have something I get to say on LalaWag, because Earlesque is a very positive site. We never want to do a post that's making fun of someone. So even when we're pointing out something that's really silly or, you know, that's mockable, we try to spin it in a very positive, look at this great person who's put themselves out there light. You know, the same sort of attitude that Andy Bio had at waxy.org when he was one of the he was one of the main people in I think in making Star Wars Kid famous, or at least was one of the main people tracking it. He was very engaged in that, in the hunt to find the real Star Wars Kid, and he got very concerned about making sure that everyone possible, as many people as possible, made it clear that they liked this kid, you know? Like, as much as, yes, we were laughing because he looked like an idiot waving around his broomstick, and yet we loved his energy and his enthusiasm. And that is something that's so important, never to punish someone for their energy and enthusiasm, that even if they end up making something that's funny because they fail, it's still like, but you did this, and it's fun,
yep.
And, it, you know, and that's great. Numa guy, definitely. I think I read that at first he didn't like the attention that he was getting, and then eventually was like, no, this is pretty cool. People really like what I'm doing. Huh?
He turned it on its head.
Yeah. We're
really out of time here. I really appreciate you coming on and joining us on the A-List in a bit of a rush show. But I thank you so much, and I'll let you get on with moving to New York City.
Oh, is there one quick thing I can plug real quick?
Yeah, go for it.
That I have a comic coming out in a couple of weeks, a web comic, and hopefully maybe I can come back on sometime to talk about it. And it's going to be called BigDamnDeal.com. In a couple of weeks,
Cool.
it'll be up.
Well,
All right.
we'll have you back on to talk about BigDamnDeal.com. Thanks so much to you, Nick, and we'll
Thank
let you
you.
go. Thanks to all of our listeners, and we'll see you next week at this time, same place, same station. Bye-bye.